Welcome to the all-new AOT podcast called the AOT Pod, the place to find your latest FRCS guidance for those taking the exam, brought to you by myself, Josh Michaels, and my co-host, Georgie Wellstead. Without further ado, let's introduce our first guest speakers. Enjoy the pod, and see you soon.
I'm Lauren Bolton, I'm a registrar based in Yorkshire, and today's theme is otitis media and sequelae. I'm pleased and privileged to be joined by Mr. David Strachan, who is a consultant otologist and cochlear implant surgeon based in Bradford. He's also one of the leads on the Bradford FRCS revision course, so he'll be very well placed to speak to us today. Thanks, Mr. Strachan, for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks very much. It's nice to be doing it.
Great. So just got some good quick-fire questions to get started. So first of all, when did you take your exam and what was going on in your life at the time of preparation?
Well, it makes me feel very old, really, because it was 1998. I had to sort of look it up. And I was a senior reg at the time. So life was pretty busy. As a senior reg, you tended to run the departments. And also I had my daughters at that point in time were 5 and 7. And I was fairly busy playing sport, golf, football. I also played in a band at that time. So it was a bit full on. And the exam had only just been introduced in its present format a couple of years before. I was hoping I was going to be escaped from actually having to do it. But there we are. That's when I did it.
I think you've already mentioned a couple, but it sounds like there were quite a few challenges when you were trying to study alongside everything. So how did you manage to balance that?
Well, I guess juggling. I guess we all have to do that. And, I guess that's the way it is when you're doing exams. So I was juggling all the previously mentioned things and just being well organized, really, I think, and targeting your time is really important. So and also having some downtime as well. You need to plan that and try and peak at the right time when you do the exam.
And to try and give everyone some optimism and hope, how did you celebrate when you passed that exam?
Right. Well, this shows how old it was. The main feeling was relief, because maybe it's still the same now, but certainly in those days, no one expected me to fail the exam. So the thought of going back to wherever I was working at the time and saying I'd failed, terrible. So I was really relieved. And then you went through and I had immediately had a glass of sherry, would you believe, with the examiners, because they read out the list of people that's passed. And those that pass have a glass of sherry. And then I had to do a mad dash to Dublin. I took it in Dublin to the airport and I nearly missed the flight home, actually. So that was a bit crazy as well.
Well, I mean, it served you on to a good career. So clearly your preparation did the trick. I'm going to move on now to the clinical scenario. So you are running an outpatient clinic and you've just reviewed a 3-year-old boy who attended with his parents. He has had a history of recurrent otalgia and fevers, which at times can be associated with otorrhea. In between episodes, he generally feels well and they don't have any concerns. He has reported that these symptoms started yesterday. They didn't bother to get a GP appointment because they knew that they were due to see you. So could you explain your differential diagnoses for this patient and how would you clinically evaluate them?
So the immediate differential is that this patient, as I'm seeing him, has got acute otitis media. But that's obviously on a background of recurrent acute otitis media. You've got to think about other differentials, which could be, I suppose, simple otitis media with effusion, which could be running alongside the recurrent episodes of acute otitis media. Could be meningitis, otitis externa as a possibility, cholesteatoma as a possibility. He's very young. Tympanic membrane perforation certainly goes through your mind. And other sort of tympanic membrane defects, such as retraction. So a developing retraction, possibly. But my main differential at that point would be acute otitis media on the background of recurrent acute otitis media. So the other thing you've just got to think about with any kid with an acute otitis media is making sure there's no obvious sign of any complications. You've got to think about complications in terms of intracranial and extracranial. If the child's unwell, I would do a quick assessment, make sure they don't have signs that might be suggestive of some serious complications. once you've sort of sussed out the kid is not severely ill, then you would take a history. That's really important. So I need to be focusing about the duration of the symptoms, the frequency of the attacks, the acute episodes, and the laterality of the symptoms. Have these symptoms always been in one ear, or is it alternating between the ears, or is it bilateral? Very important. If it's purely unilateral symptoms, that does raise more suspicions that there might be something underlying, some CSOM, perforation, or even cholesteatoma. So I think that's a really important thing to focus on. You want to discuss if there's concerns about hearing, whether the if you can get a picture of the attacks, of how they come about, and whether there's otalgia involved during the attacks and in between attacks. Is there discharge, and does the otalgia come before the discharge? And if there is discharge, what clear discharge? Is it mucoid? Is it smelly? Other otological symptoms that we do ask about, probably less relevant for a 3-year-old, I would say, tinnitus and vertigo, disequilibrium. Certainly, kids with ear problems do sometimes, mum parents say they're a bit clumsy, but those last two symptoms are probably ones that don't tend to come out in the history. The other thing you need to focus on, especially in this age group, really, is other symptoms aside from the ear, and in particular, other ENT symptoms. So, particularly nasal obstruction, rhinorrhea, snoring. If there is snoring, ask about apneic episodes. All very relevant, really. And then you move on. I would ask the patient, the parents about what has been tried previously. Have they had any treatment? Have they had a course of antibiotics, any nasal medication, etc.? Taking a sort of look at the overall development of the child, that's very important. How is he developing well? Do we know where he is on the centile, for example, in terms of his weight, particularly if there's other symptoms relating to the nose and throat? And is his speech developing okay? If there's concerns about hearing, is he behind for his age with regard to speech? So that's very important, particularly when you're talking about otological symptoms. General medical history is definitely something you should ask about. Things that are very relevant for ears would be cleft disorders, Down syndromes, things like that. And you need to know what medication children are on and if they've got any allergies. Are there any risk factors that make them more liable to having problems with their ears, such as household smoking? Are they up to date with their vaccine schedule? Is there any family history of hearing loss or family history of other ear problems? And then you talk about the examination. First thing you do is inspect. You would look at the child. Does the child look unwell? Are they seem very happy? You can also observe if they look, if they sound blocked through their nose, if they sound like they're, they've got large tonsils, and then you'd move on to the ear. So look for signs of any external inflammation. For example, look for signs of cellulitis, and particularly if they've had discharge from the ears, is that causing some erythema of the pinna? You'd look for scars, any swelling behind the ear. You look for, the loss of the postauricular sulcus. Then you move on to palpation, and they're particularly interested if there's tenderness, which can be in the tragal area or postauricular, or both actually. But that can be very helpful if you differentiate. And we mentioned otitis externa as a differential previously, and if they're tender in the tragal area, that would raise more of a concern that there might be some otitis externa, whereas postauricular, it's more likely to be acute otitis media or the complications of acute otitis media. So at that point, then you'd examine the child with the otoscope. Start with a good ear. So you're looking in the ear, you look at the ear canal, look at the tympanic membranes, specifically look at each quadrant of the tympanic membrane, and particularly look for the attic. In this particular case that we're talking about, a 3-year-old who's got a history of probable acute otitis media, I'm probably going to see a inflamed hyperemic drum, which could be bulging. There is lots of different stages of acute otitis media, and obviously you should look for any obvious retraction, any perforations, any discharge, any keratin, squamous debris. Diagnosing cholesteatoma in something like a 3-year-old, and it's pretty rare in a 3-year-old, it's not easy because usually there's discharge in the ear and you can't diagnose it at the first visit, but you still need to have it in mind. So we've had a look in the ear. You move on to a more systemic examination, which basically would involve palpation of the neck and the nose, checking for a nasal airway, look at the tonsils, and then the other simple thing that you should do is you check their temperature. Are they pyrexial? We need to know what's going on with the hearing. Now, 3-year-old's not going to be able to do a standard pure tone audiogram. What they're likely to be able to do is a play audiogram, and that requires usually two trained audiologists, and it takes time. So it's not something that tends to get done in an acute clinic situation and needs to be planned. If there were concerns about complications of acute otitis media, sepsis, mastoiditis, or even meningitis, then there are maybe scenarios where you would admit the child for treatment and further assessment. And if there was pus in the ear, you could send a sample for culture. The other thing is the scenario that this child's getting recurrent infections. Is there something about the immune system? Is there some mileage in doing full blood count with IgE testing? It depends probably on the situation. I wouldn't routinely do that as a first investigation, but if there's something to suggest there's other things going on, maybe they're getting recurrent respiratory infections or other infections, then that might be something that you would do at that first appointment.
Great, thank you. But after completing your review, thankfully the child is stable and there wasn't any signs clinically of complications from their infection, so you didn't need to do anything further. At this point, would you be able to define for me acute otitis media and recurrent acute otitis media?
Well, acute otitis media is basically the presence of inflammation in the middle ear, usually associated with some form of effusion. And it's usually a rapid onset of symptoms and signs of the ear infection. Whereas recurrent acute otitis media is obviously recurrent episodes like this. And generally, if somebody's had more, 3 or more within 6 months, then I would term that as recurrent acute otitis media, or even 4 episodes within 12 months, with at least one in the last 6 months. You could also describe resistant acute otitis media, which is when symptoms and signs sort of persist beyond a 5-day course of antibiotics, and persistent acute otitis media, where you've given antibiotics and there's recurrence of symptoms beyond 6 days, despite finishing a course of antibiotics. Generally, these patients fit into a spectrum within all those things I've just talked about.
Thank you. So now, could you please describe the background pathophysiology of acute otitis media and recurrent acute otitis media?
So acute otitis media infections can be caused by viral and bacterial infections. Viruses tends to be RSV, influenza viruses, parainfluenza viruses, rhinoviruses, adenovirus. How they cause that, the pathophysiology, it's thought to be due to passive spread through the eustachian tube, but it could also be through the blood. And of course, if a child has a perforation or grommet, then infection could spread through that route, which possibly could be associated with water exposure. Bacteria-wise, it's generally Strep pneumoniae, Haemophilus, Moxarella catarrhalis, Strep pyogenes, or good old-fashioned Staph aureus as well. It's thought that certain viral infections can make children more susceptible to bacterial infections. And it's been shown that RSV does affect sort of cell-mediated immunity. And influenza itself actually can cause neutrophil dysfunction. Viral infections can also affect the eustachian tube. There's a sort of release of inflammatory mediators from cells within the nasopharynx that affects cilia in the mucus production and mucus production, and that can lead to negative pressure, predisposing a child to both middle ear effusions and acute otitis media. There are definitely immunological features that can trigger acute otitis media. So if a ch child's not had a complete vaccination program, they're going to be more susceptible. And there can be genetic factors, because there is definitely certain families that have a tendency to get recurrent acute otitis media.
That's great, thank you. So now moving on, could you tell us what findings would you expect to see on a tympanogram and pure tone audiogram in this case?
So with a tympanogram, I'd expect it to be a type C curve with a normal canal volume. If you did the tymp in between acute attacks, you'd expect it to return to a type A curve if there's no underlying otitis media effusion. Pure tone audiogram might show a normal hearing if you do it in between attacks or a mild loss. It also can show evidence of a conductive loss in keeping with a middle ear effusion. So that can be anything from minimal hearing loss right down to 30, even 35 decibel conductive loss. It's a quite variable the extent of a hearing loss caused by a middle ear effusion.
So, can you describe what is a tympanogram?
Well, it's an objective test, and it basically looks at the compliance of the tympanic membrane. It's done by using an air pump, a speaker, and a microphone, and it generates an output that's shown on a graph with compliance along the y-axis. And it's measured in centimeters cubed. And it's the x-axis, which is the peak, if you've got a peak, is in pascals or tens of pascals, actually DA pascals.
Is there any other types of hearing tests that you're aware of for children?
Well, the younger kids in particular, the classic test is the McCormick toy test. But it's not always that easy. Whether you use a toy test or whether you're using play audiometry, it does need experienced audiologists. And some kids are very difficult to test. So sometimes you do need to try a more objective test where you're really talking about doing an ABR. But generally, not always, you need sedation or an anesthetic to complete a good quality ABR.
Thank you. So, moving back into this clinical scenario, what treatment options are available and what considerations do you need to make around this?
If we take this scenario, which is the developing acute otitis media, what sounds like over the previous 2 days, I wouldn't initially be looking at treating this with antibiotics. The NICE guidance would suggest that you would wait at that point. But what you might do is give the parents antibiotics to start if things don't settle in the next couple of days. And I'd use, so initially I would suggest paracetamol, maybe ibuprofen. And then if things don't settle over 2 days, antibiotics. Generally, in the form of amoxicillin, have used. You could also use co-amoxiclav, particularly if they've already tried amoxicillin. If you were talking about more complicated otitis media, so if the child was generally sick, then sometimes you would admit and consider surgical intervention with meningotomy and grommet, and even a cortical mastoidectomy if there's mastoiditis. But the scenario that we're talking about here, it doesn't sound like that. It sounds like I would treat it initially with paracetamol and ibuprofen, then antibiotics. However, what I would say is with all these things, you treat the patient. And therefore, if the patient is highly pyrexial, and when you look at the tympanic membrane, not only is it hyperemic, but it's bulging, and sometimes you can see obvious pus developing behind the tympanic membrane, I'd have a much lower threshold for giving antibiotics. So that's a sort of acute scenario when you're seeing the child. But then, the parents are going to want to know what you're going to do about this recurrent problem that keeps going on. And you don't necessarily have to do anything. You need to talk it through the pros and cons with the parents. But you might just say, well, let's just wait here, because the kid's three. The natural resolution of this sort of problem is usually it resolves within the next couple of years. So if there's risk factors such as smoking, vaccination, can you correct that? Or even breastfeeding's been shown to have a link. But if there's anything like that, you could try and reduce the risk factors and do watchful waiting and ask the parents to monitor the occurrence of acute otitis media. Another alternative, which I have you do use from time to time, depending on the history and the findings, is a longer course of antibiotics. There is evidence that that does reduce the recurrences. And certainly, if you've done some watchful waiting and it's still not settling, that's where I would go next. The other thing to talk through is the possibility of doing a grommet insertion. And it generally works well, but you do have to tell the parents, that there is a risk then that they will develop a chronic discharging ear. But generally, in my experience, and I think there's good evidence for it, the grommets, when there's been documented recurrent acute otitis media, does work very well.
Would you ever consider adenoidectomy in such a presentation?
I wouldn't do it as a first line unless there is significant adenoidal symptoms, frankly. But if you tried a grommet, the grommet extrudes, and they've come back again, the same problem, then I would do an EUA at the time of the second lot of grommets, and if there's any significant adenoids, I would do an adenoidectomy.
Thank you. Sort of moving away from this described scenario a bit, and we've touched on it slightly already, but could you describe for us the complications of acute otitis media?
The most simple complication is a perperforation leading to, chronic ear infections, and that's not that unusual. We can have a separate debate about at what point you might do something about that. Acute mastoiditis is the classic that everybody worries about. And what you're looking for there is signs of inflammation. And that's generally sort of swelling in the postauricular crease, so that disappears. Maybe some erythema, some tenderness. We talked about tenderness earlier when we talked about palpation, tenderness in the postauricular area. And that would be an indication for treating with antibiotics. If the child is not unwell, you could give oral. If they're unwell, I would admit and give IV. Once you start to get to situations where there is clear osteitis, inflammation of the bone, and abscesses, subperiosteal abscess can develop, then that's something that does need more active treatment and certainly needs admission to hospital. So the classic thing is a subperiosteal abscess over the mastoid. So you notice redness, a fluctuant swelling. You can get some more unusual abscesses forming where the pus tracks down in front of the pinna or down the forward part of the upper part of the sternomastoid muscle in the posterior triangle of the neck. You occasionally see things developing into a retropharyngeal or parapharyngeal abscess. These patients are usually very ill. But I would say, in terms of investigation at that point, I have a pretty low threshold for doing a CT scan. Because even if you think, well, this is a subperiosteal abscess or just a mastoiditis, you want to know, is there any issues suggestive of other complications, which including intracranial, which I'll come on to. The other thing you occasionally see is a sort of petrous apex inflammation. And the classic thing is Gradenigo syndrome, which is a triad of six nerve palsy, pain in the trigeminal nerve distribution, and obviously the middle ear infection. Pretty rare, but definitely worth knowing about, need to look out for. The other complication, and again, this is not that uncommon, is facial nerve palsy. So we sometimes see patients who the ear infection is diagnosed because of the facial palsy, or worse still, a facial palsy occurs, and whoever's seen it, whether it's in primary care or particularly A&E, haven't looked in the ear. Balanced labyrinthitis, it's possible. You can get infection pus permeating into the inner ear, which obviously can cause essential neural hearing loss and can cause significant balance problems. Pretty rare, actually. Intracranial complications, meningitis being the most common. Abscesses can occur, they can be extradural. You can get subdural empyema, well, that's pretty rare. Sigmoid sinus, that's another reason for doing the scan, looking for thrombosis of the sigmoid sinus. Encephalitis, rare but can occur alongside the other brain abscesses and even hydrocephalus. It's just one of those things that you just need to think about when you're assessing a patient who has, a significant acute ear infection. Is there something else? Are there some complications developing or have developed?
Great, thank you. I think a lot of people going to sit that exam would be interested to know if there's any sort of current literature or any guidelines that have been published that might be relevant to acute otitis media and complications.
Well, I think the main thing I would say is the NICE guidelines. You're doing the exam in the UK. You need to know that I think the NICE guidance for all the conditions you might get asked about.
Great, thanks, Mr. Strachan. So I'm just going to summarise what we've talked about now. So we've discussed acute otitis media and recurrent acute otitis media. So acute otitis media is one of the most common illnesses of childhood. It's important to distinguish between sporadic, resistant, persistent, or recurrent acute otitis media. So in terms of treating sporadic acute otitis media, we should follow the NICE guidelines, and many cases of these can be treated without antibiotics. However, there are some situations such as those who aren't improving after day three, those with otorrhea under two, systemically unwell, or showing signs of complication, then it might be relevant to give those cases antibiotics. Typically, acute otitis media is caused by viruses and bacteria. The most common viruses are RSV, influenza viruses, parainfluenza viruses, rhinovirus, and adenoviruses. And the most common bacteria are Strep pneumoniae, H. Haemophilus influenzae, Moxirella catarrhalis. There are several factors that are leading to acute otitis media, including changes related to the virus infections themselves, incomplete vaccination schedule, genetics, and also social or behavioural factors. In terms of treatment for recurrent acute otitis media, options include changing any modifiable risk factors, prophylactic antibiotics and grommet insertion, and then maybe later adenoidectomy for persistent problems. Complications from acute otitis media can be grouped into extracranial complications, which include tympanic membrane perforation, mastoiditis, petrositis, facial palsy, labyrinthitis, and intracranial complications include meningitis, extradural abscesses, subdural empyema, and sigmoid sinus thrombus. Do you have any closing remarks, Mr. Strachan?
Well, every patient is different, okay? And so it's really important to look at the patient as a whole and don't skimp on the history. So in terms of the exam, you don't fail the exam because you didn't know something complicated. It tends to be on things that are fairly easy and straightforward. And stick to simple things and stick to what you would do. Listen to the examiner as well, because the examiners, what they tell you in a scenario, there's little clues and why they mention this and why they mention that. But yeah, try not to get too stressed about it. Keep it simple. And just all they want to know is that you're a safe ENT surgeon.
Thanks, Ms. Strachan. That's invaluable advice. I'm sure everyone who's listened will really appreciate it. And it's been a really great overview. So thanks for your time, and thanks to everyone for listening.